If I might begin in our own ancient language and say how welcome you all are to Firkin Ohasarum Gref Shivanon Chirkt, Agzakohore, Firkin Folge, Erre of Canary, as Yitzana will servish pipely, Corre and Dundown, Aka, Harnablianta. Dear friends, it's my pleasure to welcome such a distinguished group to Áras an Uachtaráin and indeed to Ireland, and I hope, looking at your programme, I am quite sure that you have had a fruitful first day of discussion on what is the first plenary meeting of the Interaction Council to be held on Irish soil. In that regard, I'm very particularly pleased to welcome the co-chairs Bertie Ahern and Mr. Olasegun Babasanko. Bertie Ahern is a former colleague of mine in Parliament and in Cabinet, a member of our Council of State, and indeed someone who has made a very significant contribution to peace and inclusive governance on this, not just on this island, but abroad. But for those of you who are seeing Ireland for the first time, I also hope that this initial visit will inspire you to come back and explore further the many human and natural riches that this island harbours. It is a land where an ancient Celtic civilization was infused and reshaped by visitors, by Viking and later Anglo-Norman influences, and then, of course, by the harsh stamp of centuries of colonization by our nearest neighbour, with whom we have now forged strong bonds of friendship, symbolized by, for example, the exchange visits of our heads of state, and I have to tell you, put into practice every day in the social, cultural, economic and political realms. This is what has created the unique social and cultural tapestry that is contemporary Ireland, a contemporary Ireland that is celebrating diversity, continually changing. But I'm very glad to have this opportunity to meet you and to reflect with you on some of the shared challenges, but I emphasise also the possibilities for cooperation and renewal that lie ahead of us in this new century. Your experience, as we would say in Irish, an tahe ato agiv, your experience as former statesmen and women and the freedom you now have to think, reflect, suggest and indeed act with the wisdom that a long-term view allows, emancipated as you are from the too often insatiable and impatient pace of demanding daily active political life, this wisdom is a precious asset which you bring to the collective tasks of this new generation and the generations to come. The foundation of the Interaction Council in 1983 and the particular contributions, for example, of Helmut Schmidt, Takeo Fukuda and Pierre Trudeau had the aim of combining that wisdom of experience that I speak of, a wisdom of experience gathered in government with the most rigorous analytical scholarship from the academy. Ideas, meeting with experience. The International Declaration on Human Responsibilities in 1997, which I've read, carried this spirit forward. And now, 20 years later, and on the eve of the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights at the United Nations, it has, of course, a renewed importance. We are, all of us now on this planet, in possession of two international agreements, which is the great achievement of 2015. One in Paris and the other in New York. The first, an agreement to tackle the impact of climate change, and the second, a call to replace what was exploitative development with sustainable development. And our world is a world of multi-layered structural, political and technological changes that you also have been discussing. These changes, I emphasise, are both understandable and, yes, they are amenable to an ethical response if we can create a global consciousness that is respectful of diversity and committed, as it must be, to intergenerational justice. We are, as all of you so well know, faced with challenges that are now interacting on a global scale. Population expansion, migration, climate change, desertification, deforestation, water shortages, dramatic situations of conflict and war, changing trade conditions, and indeed with the possibility of a resile to a narrow assertion of, if you like, narrow interests on the part of the most powerful. These are all issues that remind us of the web of interdependency that weaves all of our nations together, as well as weaving us all, humans and non-humans, to Mother Earth, Terra Madre, as it is expressed in many of your countries. They are also crucial issues that have yet to be met with an adequacy of mind and heart, and indeed translated into policy. I sometimes wonder, when I hear discussions of migration into Europe, for example, what is after all 1.2 million people entering a population centre of 501 million, have people even begun to consider what the significance it will be before the middle of this century, when 40% of the young people of the planet will be on the continent of Africa, 24% of the population, and the challenges that it offers to us all. You are so right in identifying something that is very important, the significance of water as a source of international conflict. It is something that must be shared if we are to avoid that conflict. Then too, there is the delivery of science and technology within a sustainable and inclusive framework, and that is a theme you are discussing. I believe myself that we must have the courage to enable science and technology to leap over borders of space and time if we are to create new options of application in the most populated parts of the planet. We cannot wait for an adjustment that will in fact allow as a residuum the very, very necessary applications of science and technology that can address the demographic issues that I speak, for example. Indeed, we must never allow ourselves, I suggest, to forget that the unresolved issues, and they are unresolved, of global poverty, food insecurity, environmental degradation, unsustainable levels of debt, abuses of power by both commission and omission, they are the legacies of our paradigms of thought and practice that are simply insufficient and are failing. And in their failure, they are presenting us with challenges as a global community. And yours are the voices that can call, usher in the new paradigms of thought, policy, and practice, and cooperation and interaction that we need. And we must have the courage, of course, not just to identify the crippling contradictions of our age, but also we must encourage our citizens to empower themselves with the necessary information and intellectual skills, a new literacy, if you like, that will challenge the assumptions that sustain those contradictions and that falsely present them to our peoples as somehow or another either natural or inevitable. Is it not the case, for example, that the narrow theory of interest that motivates the foreign policy of too many nations is the source of some of our greatest collective problems, be it from unfair trade to a reluctance to decisively tackle global warming? Is it not the case that an uncritical theory of growth that is not submitted to the tests of sustainability and inclusiveness, cohesion in Europe, for example, has made us blind to the destruction of the natural systems upon which human life and all forms of life ultimately depend? Is it not also the case that a focus on a bureaucratic efficiency, a limited form of utility and performance, has too often led us to ascribe value, understood primarily as market value, to some spheres of human life at the expense of others? In that regard, I was delighted to learn that work and its future was one of the themes you examined in your opening session this morning. Indeed, a wide-ranging debate on the connections between market competition, social cohesion, ecology and work in conditions of change, globally, regionally and locally, is as necessary as it is pressing. Our times are ones that invite us to revisit the definitions of work with which we've lived for decades, so as to celebrate work in all its aspects and forms, producing but also caring, work of the hand, work of the heart, work of the imagination, work within the market, work outside of the market. Redefining work goes far beyond saving the demand curve of our economies. We are called upon to return to issues of distribution, the role of the state from which we've retreated, the balance of work and life, the transition from sufficiency to insatiability, and all of the consequences of that transition to insatiability. So the possibilities open, for example, by the debate on the universal basic income approach, which I understand you discussed earlier today, are among the proposals that acknowledge the issue of distribution, and that are promising, I think, in a context where policymakers are challenged to craft new policy tools and measures that will be adequate to the fundamental objectives of human development in a sustainable way, security and dignity. This perspective demands that we move beyond any reduction of the citizen to a unit of labour. A unit of labour that it is assumed that is ever in readiness for reallocation across sectors and boundaries of societies and economies. This, I believe, is a reductive fallacy of inadequate abstract economic theory. We do need good economics within an ethical and cultural framework. And my conviction, dear friends, is that the invention of new connections between, in some cases, restored connections between ethics, economy, and ecology must be at the core of all work of political and intellectual reconstruction in this century. This was a central point in the conversation I had last week in Rome with Pope Francis. And indeed, I have to say, with Prince Charles when he visited me here just 2 weeks ago. I'm aware too that the need to anchor ethics firmly at the heart of public action has been, in, for yourselves, a pillar of the activities of the Interaction Council since its foundation in 1983. Indeed, a revived ethic of care and solidarity, a holistic approach to human interdependency and vulnerability, is what I believe must be established as the informing principle of a renewed political practice if we are to respond together and adequately to the challenges of our age in the spheres of peace building, international development, trade, finance, agriculture, and food production, and of course, environmental protection. If I may take up with the last item in this list, it is obvious that the challenge posed to us by climate change is not just of a scientific or economic kind. It is, above all else, an ethical challenge, calling for a revolution in consciousness and modes of thinking. The fight against global warming invites us, I repeat, to accept the responsibility of intergenerational justice. As the Prime Minister of India said in his address at the 2015 Paris conference, as he put it, to care for the world we shall not see. Are we ready to depart from economic models that encourage trade-offs in favour of the present to the detriment of the future? Are we ready for a moral leap such as will enable us to construct our policies transnationally on a normative basis? Can we abdicate from some of the hubris we inherited from those such as Francis Bacon in an enlightenment gone wrong, as I put it, and embrace instead a new ethic of responsibility, one of symmetry with nature? Can we leave behind the old hegemonic tropes of industrial and technical mastery? Bacon, I think, said, "I lead to you nature and all her children in bondage for your use, to gouge out her secrets." I think, can we leave behind all of this, the dominion of man over nature, and instead return the human being to a meaningful place within nature, in symmetry, seen as a dwelling place, a wellspring of nourishment and inspiration? In our seeking of an adequate ethic for the challenges of our times, an ethic which will heal the separation with nature, address the global reach of our actions, and protect the right of future generations to dwell in harmony on our shared planet, I believe that we can draw from a variety of philosophical and cultural sources, as well as from those old patterns of wisdom and ancient mythic systems of which all our respective cultures have kept the memory. Our use of science and technology will better serve humanity, may I suggest, if it is ethically and culturally framed. Marfakelskur, to end, dear friends, let us recognise new realities, demographic, cultural, environmental, moral, that will shape our future and respond to them with political ambition, intellectual courage, and creative innovation, but also with respect for the ethic of memory and cultural sensitivity, so that we might explore more fully the uncharted and fruitful intersections between science, technology, economy, and yes, ethics, and vernacular knowledge too, For let us remember next year when we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration on Rights. It is wrong to see those universal rights either defined or put forward as a Western creation. The core of them in all of their diversity is there in the ancient belief systems, both revealed and non-revealed, around the world. At a juncture when the voices of fear and entrenchment are everywhere, but they're everywhere becoming louder, let us not relent either in our efforts to affirm that ours is a world that requires more, not less, solidarity, more, not less, understanding of complexity, diversity, and more, not less, of cooperation on the common issues facing humanity. And that's why I'm so pleased that you were all from all different parts of the world to be able to come here. And I was so delighted when Bertie Ahern wrote to me and afforded me the opportunity of welcoming you. For I know that these principles that I've been mentioning are at the core of your actions as members of the Interaction Council. So may I then wish you all the very best in your future endeavours. Fruitful discussions tomorrow and an enjoyable few days in Dublin City. Gwimgachra, agus banacht ar grinnú mórach, agus ar abar an cóla idir gynni fiachta sa tachy. Is ta súl am gamenhi sif salt as ar gud am an maio a clia. Is gara míle máchi. Thank you very, very much for visiting me and thank you for affording me the opportunity of presenting you these remarks. Thank you.